From 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, it's The Bill. Conversations with entrepreneurs and innovators about their dreams, their triumphs, and their challenges.
Portfolios. We're used to associating portfolios with creative professionals like writers or artists. However, the concept of a portfolio life has become essential for survival, not just as an entrepreneur, but in almost any profession. Today on The Build, I'm talking with serial entrepreneur Rodney Goldston. He's going to tell us how experiences he earned as an employee in various Fortune 100 companies helped him build a successful solo consulting practice. He'll also share his list of the skills you'll need to work on to make an impact in your career. It's the story of Jughead Media, coming up next on The Build.
The Build is made possible with support from 2820 Press, providing business consulting and content strategy services to customer-obsessed companies nationwide. More information at 2820press.com.
It's The Build. I'm Joe Taylor, Jr., joined this week by Rodney Goldston, founder of Jughead Media. Welcome.
And RodneyGoldston.com.
We'll talk a little bit about the distinctions between the two, but we often collect origin stories on The Build. And so tell me a little bit. I think we share some common backgrounds. We both kind of came from large organizations. And at a certain point, there was a little bit of a kick to go from being a key player in a big team to a founder. So tell me what that journey was like for you.
Thank you, Joe, for having me. And for me, it's been several things. So I've worked for several large organizations, starting with when I graduated from Temple back in the 90s. My first job was with a company called Lucent Technologies. Loved my job. I wanted to retire from Lucent. I wanted to be a sales trainer. I was on the path to move to Colorado, and I was doing real well as a salesperson. And I showed up for work one day, and they had sold our entire division. So none of us across the country worked for the company anymore. And I didn't want to work for the new company. So I decided to start a company called Stealth Marketing. And I developed a technology called AdTrack that I sold to auto dealers. And what we did was we monitored offline response rates for dealers. Essentially, we sold them toll-free numbers. Right? So if a dealer had 10 ads running simultaneously, we give them 10 separate toll-free numbers. And we'd monitor, it's called dial number identification service, the information passed over the phone lines for the dealer and report on it in real time. Right? So I did that for about 4 years and decided this is too hard, it's too difficult, you know, growing a business. I'm a Fortune 100 guy. I'll go back to work. Right? And so I bounced around a little bit and then eventually landed at General Motors. Right? And thought I'd retire from General Motors. and sure enough, came in, and this was in 2008, right? So I'd been there, I guess, maybe 2 years or so, and 2008 rolled around. And I'm a little slow sometimes on the uptake. I should have saw it coming. But hindsight is 2020 vision. We were closing dealers down every week. And that, my clients for General Motors Finance were the auto dealerships. And came into work one day, and lo and behold, the automotive crisis had hit. And I worked for General Motors, and my office was the first one that got shut down. And I had a good friend who was in banking at the time, and he does reverse mortgages. His name is Don Graves. If you need a reverse mortgage, call Don Graves. You can reach him at dongraves.com. And Don said, Rod, I'm going to teach you how to do this. He was, at the time, was, I believe, the top reverse mortgage rep in the country for any lender. And he said, I'm going to show you how to do this. This will be the easiest thing you've ever done. Right? I said, great, Don, show me how to do this. I leave and I go to work for a company called IndyMac Bank, which was owned at the time by Lehman Brothers. And 30 days later, the banking collapse hit and they shut down. Right? So we spent about a year there and bounced over to Wells Fargo. I think I spent maybe 3 years at Wells Fargo before they pulled out of the reverse mortgage space. MetLife hired almost all the reverse mortgage people across the country, I think, and actually in the onboard, and people didn't realize Met had a bank, but overnight, Met was the biggest reverse mortgage player in the country after Wells Fargo pulled out. And in the onboarding meeting announced to us, in the room where they just brought us all in to train us, that they were selling their bank. People started to cry and It was like something biblical, wailing and moaning and gnashing of teeth. And I decided at that point that I was going to go back into business for myself. And I had started this company. It was called, at the time, called Flagship Digital Advertising. And what I wanted to do was do digital screenage, digital signage. So I was ahead of that curve, believe it or not. And when I first launched it, placing the digital screens was easy because of the economy. Finding advertisers was difficult. Right? And so it really sat for a while. And when this whole thing with Met came about and getting laid off, I decided to go back to work for myself. And I did business under that name, Flagship Digital, for a bit, but then changed to the Jughead Media. And people ask me, why do you call it Jughead? I get this question all the time. They either ask me, is it because I was in the military? And I say, no, those are Jarheads, right? Not Jugheads. They ask me if it's about the Archie's comics. And I say, no, it's actually, I named the company after a Prince song called The Jughead.
Oh, okay.
So back in the, I think it was on the, I don't know which album was that. I believe the album was came out around 96 or 97. It was one where he wrote Slave on his face.
Yeah. It was one of the New Power Generation.
Yeah, it was a New Power Generation. Yeah. Oh, you're a Prince fan?
Oh, yeah. We're going to get along just fine.
No wonder we get along. So anyway, so doing the Jughead. And the first time I heard the song, the very first time I heard it, I kept a section of my planner at the time called Someday Maybe. I wrote down in the planner, start a company called Jughead. And that's how it came about.
And there you go. The interesting thing out of that story is when I've been talking with entrepreneurs for years, but specifically for this series, and folks keep saying the fear that many folks experience when thinking about starting their own company is, where's the job security going to come from? And you're telling a story that I've heard again and again, which is, oh, I'm going to retire from this company. It's going to be, this is a big Fortune 100 company. There's no, you know, I'll be able to have a gig here for 40 years. And what happens is, in our current economy from the last 10, 15 years, you don't know until you roll into the office that you've been traded like you're a baseball player, mm-hmm. or even worse, the company has just gone out of business or folded a certain portion of its operations. So tell me a little bit about how you have taken what you've learned in those cases and started to structure some security for yourself as a business owner.
So I don't know that we have security in what we're doing. One of the things that Seth Godin always says that I agree with is that we have to be doing things that might not work. Right? So as an entrepreneur, I'm not afraid to launch, but what happens is I'm always afraid month to month, right? You know, I'm like, oh my God, am I going to lose a client? You know, am I going to pay the bills this month? So I'm never really afraid to launch, to get out there. I have a business idea every day, right? And I was with my buddy Don, actually, and he had read a book called Entrepreneurial DNA. He was telling me about that. Describes various types of entrepreneurs, categorizes them, which I thought was very interesting. And he talked about Sir Richard Branson and the Virgin conglomerate, I guess you would call it. And Richard Branson is an opportunist, right? So he sees an opportunity and he takes advantage of it. And I think that's the category I fit into. I walk down the street and I say, oh, that's a business. You know, I can be in 10 different businesses. And really the skill I think I need to develop is how to structure those, how to structure a team around the business, like to get one really going and have somebody running it, or have, you know, a group running it so it doesn't need me day to day, and then move on to this opportunity over here. And there are different types of entrepreneurs. And I think it's important to figure out what type you are. And I just got that literally last week. Like, oh, I'm an opportunist. Right?
You know? So along those lines, a lot of folks will see an idea when something gets presented in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. Here's a new company. Mm-hmm. Oh, Uber. Oh, what an obvious idea. I could have started that. But the reality is it's often folks making the decision to take that idea and actually turn it into something. So right. What enables you to actually go from identifying what could be a good business idea and actually executing it, launching it?
So if I go back to stealth marketing and AdTrack, and what actually happened was I was doing something else and talking to auto dealers, uncovered a need, and also that there were only two big companies at the time doing it. And I became a pretty prominent regional player. So one, there wasn't a lot of companies doing it. We were still in the age of people trying to figure out what the internet was. And so I had built an analytics product before we had analytics as a word, right? And so because I understood technology and liked it, and I love marketing, I was able to put together a solution to the problem. I think that the key for an entrepreneur really is being able to observe the world they live in. And when I say world, your world could be Southwest Philly, right? And so you don't have to be the best marketer or hoagie maker in the world. If your world is Southwest Philly or a 10-block radius in Southwest Philly or West Philly, that's your world. Can you become the best marketer in Upper Darby? Can you become the best marketer in Southwest Philly, the best hoagie maker or the best whatever? So how we define world, I think, you know, needs to change. So a lot of times entrepreneurs think, well, I've got to be Nike or I've got to be number one. And I think one of the things, Joe, that I find more than any time in the history of our country is that we can make a living. I don't have to be Phil Knight, right? I don't have to be making $1 million. I can make $100,000 out of my basement, you know, with one or two clients. And I think that that's what technology has enabled us to do. And, you know, companies like Google, I tell people all the time, get certified with Google doing something. Google at one point was certifying photographers. You know, you can go out and take pictures, I mean, you know, with the 360 thing, and you could make a ton of money, right? And people didn't understand that. So one of the best things I did, and the second thing I did, was it started with me just getting certified through Google, you know, and learning to do AdWords. And I was able to pick up a contract to start just doing AdWords. And starting with AdWords grew into, you know, we manage the websites, we provide content, we do analytics. So you don't necessarily today have to start your own thing. You can latch on to something that's already being done. A lot of times, though, what happens is if you get in the game too late, you know, for example, I'm a HubSpot partner, but man, there are, you know, I don't know how many there are now, right? You know, so if you get in the game too late, right? Seth Godin again says, you know, the best time to start something is always, you know, typically, you know, maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when it gets talking about technology or blogging. The second best time is now, right? And so now is always a good time, so that we should act. And getting into working or back to working, I think a lot of times what happens is that when we are working for the man, you know, we just don't have a lot of time. You know, if you're going to work 40, 50, 60 hours a week and don't have a family, my God, you know, it's like, you know, now, I mean, you just, your hours are consumed. It's very difficult to much think about something, much less start something, because you just don't have the hours in a day. You know, you got to sleep 8 hours. So for me, quitting cold turkey. So my motive of operation has always been, I'm just going to quit. So when I was working at Lucent and they decided they were going to sell a company, I met an auto dealer named Jerry Miller. Actually, he owns the Audi and Porsche stores in the Philly area. By chance, I met Jerry and he befriended me. On the first meeting, we're talking and he said, young man, you either need to do your job or you need to do this business. That was on a Tuesday. I'll never forget. It was on a Tuesday morning. Wednesday, I decided to just quit my job. And my wife came downstairs and said, aren't you going to work? I said, I met this guy, Jerry Miller, told me I should quit. But the good thing
was, what was her reaction to that? She's like, oh my God, it was the biggest, give me this man's address so I can kill him.
It was a blowout, right? The thing is, though, we never looked back, you know. And during that time, Joe, I'll tell you, man, I drove luxury cars. We never missed a mortgage payment. We saved money. And I'm not saying that it was easy, right? Because, you know, it wasn't easy. But, you know, there was I'm a believer. I'm a Christian. So I say there's a level of faithfulness that our needs were met and beyond our needs, to be honest with you. And so, you know, because the first time I did that, I saw a level of success. Then I chose to go back to work. And so it became easier for me to just say, you know what, I can make it on my own. Right. So I know that I can figure out something to do that I can provide a living for myself and my family.
I think one of the things that you're touching on is there's a thread of conversations I've seen over the past few months about the concept of looking at your career as a series of tours of duty, a lot of the veterans that I work with tell me that it's easy for them to conceptualize this because they would say, well, I did 3 years doing X, I did 3 years doing Y, and now I'm going to do 3 years running this business and maybe I'll sell that and do 3 years doing the next thing. There's a great book on the market called Grind Hopping that takes the same approach. The idea that as it gets harder for us to find companies where we can work for 30, 40, 50 years, if you conceptualize this idea of what's the project I'm working on now and what's the next project. So for you, it sounds like that's one mode, but it seems like thinking about this from a project by project standpoint has also given you a little bit more control over that work-life fit.
I just really start thinking about it that way. So Jeff Goins just wrote a book and he talks about living a portfolio-based life. And I really just start seeing it that way, that, you know, when you think about this idea of we should be doing things that might not work, right? Those are the only things worth doing, right? That's the only time we can really carve out a niche for ourselves is if there is no path, right? Because if there's a path, if Joe's already done this, And it's working for Joe. Well, one, Joe's my competition, and there's probably 50 people like Joe already doing it. And so I've got to figure out something that works for me, and it might not work. And so it becomes a project. So I'm going to try this for the next year. So I'm going to give it a year. If it works, then maybe we'll do it. You know, maybe it becomes a big business, or maybe it becomes something that we do for the next 4 or 5 years, and then we move on to the next project. And so that's exactly what, by, I don't want to say by mistake or just maybe by default, has kind of happened. I've got this portfolio of things I've done, right? So I've got some great work I've done for big companies, but then I've got a whole bunch of stuff as well that I've done on my own. And so, you know, I've run a direct mail center because I did it for other dealers. I did it out of my house. I still get the Pitney Bowes stuff in the mail, right? If the guy came to my house a couple of years ago, and I'd been closing. He said, you're my largest client. He must have been new. He said, you're my largest client. I said, really? I've been shut down for like 3 years, man, right? So I said, that's sad. But so I've done, you know, direct mail. I've run a direct mail operation. I had a content development company before we knew what it was. I owned a newsletter service we sold to auto dealers called Behind the Wheel, where we just provided all the content. They just paid us. We did everything. We handled the mailing, the writing, you know, all that type of stuff. So I've got this portfolio, like you said, and it's been built around doing these projects, these entrepreneurial projects over the years. And I think one of the things that, so in marketing and what we do, you know, there's a concept of being a specialist versus being a hybrid, right? And I'm very much a hybrid. Matt Cutts is very much a specialist, right? You know, and I tell folks all the time, if I don't think Matt Cutts takes on clients because he's with Google, but I said, if you could hire Matt Cutts or Danny Sullivan, please hire them, right? Because, and invite me to the meeting because I'm reading all their stuff and I want to be in the meeting and I want to hear what they have to say. But if you can hire them, right, I'm a good hybrid, right? And so I can piece a lot of things together. So we have, in marketing, this idea of should I be a specialist or should I be a hybrid? And I think that's a decision that people have to make for themselves. I see that, you know, you can make money doing both. I think making money as a specialist takes a little longer, but if you do, you probably make more money. But being a hybrid for folks, I think like you and I, it becomes, can you do a newsletter? Yes, right? And the first time I got asked that question, my auto dealer, I had no clue. I was there to talk about something else, and they said, well, we've been wanting to do this newsletter. Can you do one for us? Yes. Yes, I can do it. And I had to go and call a friend of mine who's been a wonderful mentor to me, and he was running an agency at the time. I says, how do you do this newsletter? I don't know what to charge. You know, and he showed me how to do this. And I'm very much a hybrid. So I see, if I was a doctor, I see myself kind of just as a family practitioner. I can diagnose and I can help and I can bring in other specialists when the project gets beyond what I can do on my own.
So rule one sounds like if you've made the sale, stop selling, you know, say yes, and then figure out how to deliver.
When someone asks you, can you do this? If you want to be a hybrid, just say yes, you know, and go figure out how to do it.
So, rule two is figuring out how to create that demand among potential customers and clients. So for you, what's the process like to cultivate potential new clients for your business?
So, you know, in today's world, you know, the HubSpot answer is, you know, just through content development. But there's so much content on the internet now. I think old school networking will never go away. You know, we talked earlier about a big opportunity I'm working on now that we can't talk about, right? But that really just came about because of face-to-face meetings. I actually walked past a lady a few years ago on the street. Didn't know. My wife recognized her as someone going, we go to a big church, over 1,000 people. So it's, you know, very difficult to just know someone. And so I think that lady goes to our church. And we stopped her, literally walking the street. Hey, do you go to Covenant Fellowship? Yes. Got to be friends with her just casually over a number of years. And through that encounter on the street is how this other opportunity really, that's one of the ways it came about. So, you know, this idea of, you know, developing content and people will find you, and people find JK Media all the time on the internet, fill out my form, but it's very difficult to turn that into business sometimes. And particularly when you are in an environment where you've got larger agencies, right? And so, you know, I think that that becomes difficult. I'm good at networking. I wrote an article on RodneyGoldson.com a few weeks ago about just saying hi. You know, I like people. Right? And so if you put me in a room with 100 people or 1,000 people and just give me enough time, I eventually have met them all because I like talking to people. And out of talking to people, we find opportunities. And so when I leave here, actually, I'm going right over to Chestnut Street. No, it wasn't a Benjamin. It wasn't the thing Benjamin's Desk did a while back. It was another networking event I just happened to go to. I met a guy at the bar. You know, we were sitting around having drinks. And, you know, he turns out, he says, you know, the franchise has Infusionsoft for us. And I'm just really confused. And I said, well, I happen to be certified in HubSpot. They all work the same, right? He says, can you help me? Yes.
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 And then immediately run to Amazon and get the manual on
it. He's got it. He's going to give it to me. I've got the manual. I don't even need the manual, though. They all work.
It sounds like that's the structure of being a successful hybrid entrepreneur, is knowing how to adapt set of things that you've learned to new situations.
Right. And with crowdsourcing and networking, you know, so for example, you specialize in video and audio. So if I got a project, a really big project, I could always come say, hey, Joe, let's partner on this, right? Or if you get someone says, you know, we need to do some analytics and have a really good person. Oh, I know a guy, right? And the project can run through, you know, 2020 Press, and maybe we partner on it. So I think that, you know, in the world we are in today and in the economy we're in today, one, you know, there's all this hype about social media and connecting. But it's really difficult to truly connect with people over Twitter and Facebook. You got 1,000 followers, I can't connect with 10,000 people, but I can connect with Joe, right? I can meet Joe here, do a podcast and say, you know, Joe and I have a commonality. We like funk music, right? Do you like coffee, Joe?
I don't like coffee.
Oh, well, see that.
Which is ironic because the first guest on our series is a coffee manufacturer. All so
right. I like three things. I like Starbucks coffee, funk music, and barbecue.
Okay.
Not necessarily in that order. Right? And I can get along with just about anybody who likes those three things. But the point is about connecting. And so, you know, there's a connection made because I attended an event a few months ago and the connection gets made and we, you know, do something. And so that's building that network. And you never know where that might take you and what opportunities might come up from that.
A few episodes back, we interviewed a young lady named Amber Wanner, in her mid-20s, already running a highly successful company called Candidate. And mm-hmm. She told us the same thing. She is a combination technical recruiter and matchmaker. Mm-hmm. And she built this company with nothing but a one-page landing page, big technology behind it, because her secret sauce was leveraging presence at events. Mm-hmm. So the flip side of that is I think we've both met a lot of folks that come from this notion that there must be some way to either make money online or develop a business where you don't necessarily have to leave the house. So what would you say to an entrepreneur that might be a little more introverted, that may be less comfortable about getting face to face with folks? How can they overcome some of that fear or some of that nervousness about interacting with people?
Okay, so overcoming fear with interacting with people, I think you just have to do it. Take a class if you have to. Go to Udemy. There's got to be a class, right? It's got to be something that you could, if you really aren't good at that. But I think this idea of, you know, making money online, and I don't make money online, right? I've made a lot of money through the internet and with technology, but I never, even with my blog, there's nothing for sale on RodneyGoldston.com. And I made $1,000 in 1 hour about a year ago because someone read a blog post and said, "Can you come talk to some kids about this for me? We'll pay you." And I thought, yeah.
Yes. Right. And if, rule one, yes.
Right. And that person, it turns out, works for Kenny Gamble's charter school organization. And so through not trying to sell anything, but just I wrote a blog post called 7 Things Anyone Can Do to Be Successful in a Digital Marketplace. So this guy reads it. Works for the organization, says, "I want you to come talk to our kids about it. We'll pay you," which I would have done for free, by the way. And I go there, I do this talk, meet all these wonderful kids, educators. They offer me a job on the spot, really, after I said, "Can you come in and work with our kids?" And I turned down the job, but it put me in that network again. And so through the writing, you know, now I've developed another network. So I think that, you know, it gets back to what you were saying earlier, but it's a project. So I've got RodneyGoldston.com over here, right? And it's been a project now for about 3 years, right? So I've been blogging and writing, and I just write about the things that I like. Stephen Biko, the South African, wrote a book called I Write What I Like. And that's really my motto for my blog. I just write what I like. It tends to, you know, be focused on marketing, success type stuff. But I write the things that I like. I write what comes out of me. I'm not trying to sell anything, right? And so I'm not driven by that. And so, you know, these things come out, I write. And, you know, I was just telling you that Startup Grind picked me up as a writer just this week. But in the application you fill out, they ask you to point to your own blog or writing. And so there's nothing like this. You know, you won't find a whole bunch of stuff on my site, like, you know, 7 things you can do for this, or, you know, 8 ways. I wrote a blog post a couple months ago called, I really offended a lot of people when I wrote it. You're just average if you're working for the man. Right. And I didn't mean any harm by it. But what I was trying to say was that if you understand what it takes to be an employee in the world, employers need average people. Right. For the most part, you can be an exceptional employee, but employers are not looking for the top person in a videography. They're not, because they can't hire that person. Right. They can't. Right. And so the standard becomes very average. And so what happens, I find, is when we go into working, right, so when we become an employee, right, it's very difficult to become excellent, because to become excellent, because companies have rules. And if you break them, they fire you. And so you end up remaining very average, right? And that the only way to become excellent at something is to get out of that environment. And so that if you remain, you might be an excellent employee. I'm not, because, you know, employees that make millions of dollars, right? You can make millions of dollars as an employee. So I like being an employee. I love my job at General Motors. I absolutely love the job I had at Lucent Technologies, and I love the job I had at Wells Fargo and MetLife. I wanted to retire from all those places, never wanted to leave. I was always forced out through mergers and selling and things of that nature. So I don't have anything against employees. I just think we need to understand that the only way to really become excellent at something is to get out of that. You have to, and not that you can't make money, right? That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if you want to be excellent in it, if you want to be excellent in and what will we call this? Videography, audio?
Call it content development.
Content development, right. So if you go to work for a company, that company's going to have rules. They're going to have rules about what you can write, what you can say. You can write whatever you like. You can do a Stephen Biko, right? I write what I like. And you can write what comes out of you. But I got an email one morning. Well, let me get back to how I started the blog. I started the blog because Seth Godin told me to, believe it or not. Google had us down at an event, the Google partners at an event in New York. Seth Godin was a speaker. And anyone remember Welcome Back, Kotter and Arnold Horseshack? And what Arnold Horseshack used to do whenever he knew the answer to something or had a question, he'd go, ooh. So when they opened the questions up to Seth Godin, I did an Arnold Horseshack. Ooh. So I'm jumping up and down. And they said, you. And so the first question I asked was, I had just started this idea with Jughead Media. And my question was something along the lines of, well, you know, I've got this agency I'm trying to do, and I got certified through Google, but you know, I'm reading about personal branding and all that kind of thing. I don't know what to do, Seth. And Seth said, well, when you're small, you're always the brand. And he said, you should have a blog. That next day I came back and I launched RodneyGoldson.com. And so, you know, we have a blog over on Jughead Media, but where I really enjoy writing and spending my time is over at RodneyGoldson.com, because I write what I like. I write what comes out of me. I'm trying to think of the author who wrote Newsjacking.
David Meerman Scott.
Yes, David Meerman Scott. So, you know, I'm doing this blogging and I read all of David's books as well, right? So Newsjacking and all that. And so I'm this huge fan of Seth and David. And I'm reading David's blog one day, and he had written, when the guy who did the map app, I guess it was for the iPhone 4 at the time, or iPhone 5, got fired, David wrote a post about that, and I kind of differed on the opinion, and I wrote a response to it on my blog, and I think the title was called "What Would Steve Jobs Do?" Like, you know, kind of WWJD thing, right? And it was called "What Would Steve Do?" A response to David Meerman Scott. So I write this, and then I comment on David's blog that, you know, I kind of have a different opinion, and you know, here it is over here. So I wake up one morning, and I remember it was on a Sunday, and I was laying in bed, and I don't have any comments aren't not enabled on my blog. And that's kind of, you know, a Seth Godin thing, right? It's like, I just don't have any comments, right? So I get this email, and it's from David Meerman Scott. And I like fall out of the bed, literally. I'm like, oh my God, Angie, David Meerman Scott sent me an email. And the email basically just says, hey, I read this blog post. He said, this made my day. And I'm like, I made David Meerman Scott's day, right? You know, and he just goes on about the blog post. And he goes, and that thing you wrote on 7 things anyone can be successful, that is great. And I felt like just so good that, you know, and I thought, oh my God, man, I don't have comments turned on. My blog would blow up if anyone saw that David Meerman Scott had read my stuff. Right? I'd be an overnight success. So, but, you know, for me, that was worth more than money.
Well, it's the validation that someone like that you respect.
What you're doing is
sees
you, that in this environment where we're trying to be, what's the term I want to use for influence, you know, when we're writing content, that you actually do that. That someone who is literally, you know, making a lot of money doing this and is probably, you know, one of the top 5 marketers in the world reads this and says, this is great. Right. So, yeah, it really did, you know, but that's what I really love to do. So on Jughead Media, that's where I make my money, right? And I make money on the internet by providing services. And I think, you know, getting back to the initial question you were asking, for me, it's always been through services. So I've never been an internet guy that makes money by showing people how to make money on the internet, you know, or because you get those people, right? You know, and I'm not saying they don't make money. They don't know what they're doing.
But there is a group of those people.
Yeah, right. You know, just pay me and I'll show you how to make money. Right. So that's never been me. Me, it's just always been, I'm going to find a need, identify a need, and I'm going to develop a service around that need. You know, and so that has worked for me.
Well, I think it echoes what we observe a lot in our organization, which is that we've kind of hit this era of what we keep calling content, and the TV and radio producer in me keeps cringing when we hear it called content, because it's like, well, what's it go into? But since we call it that now, audiences use that more to validate their assumption about who you are than they do to decide. You know, I don't know that anybody decides they're going to wake up today and say, I want to do business with someone who's written a listicle of, you know, 5 content management systems. Like, what I want to do is connect with somebody that I think I can trust to solve this problem.
Right.
And now let me go look at their blog to make sure they're not a psycho. So, well, or if we want a psycho, maybe we do want this.
So, yeah, and that's one idea. But I think when you have a project or portfolio-based life, as you develop a portfolio, then the online content becomes less important. Because what I can tell people real quick, I had 100 auto deals as clients. That's my validation. Didn't matter if I write anything. I never screwed anybody over. You know, I did an excellent job for every client I've ever had. Here they are. Here's my portfolio. You know, and I've worked for these big companies. Here's my list of managers. Call them. I'm still good friends with one of my first managers, Joe Jones at Lucent. He's out in Florida now living the retired life. Right? He's living the life. I'm still grinding it out. But, you know, I'll tell folks, hey, call Joe Jones. Right? You want some validation that I know what I'm talking about, that I know sales? Well, call this guy. Right? So I think when you're starting out, that's important. And I think it's important also now because a lot of people do find us, you know, via the internet and they read the things that we write. But, you know, when people are looking to do business with you, you know, there's a saying in sales that people do business with people they like and they trust, right? And, you know, I can write anything. You know, I can grab a Seth Godin book or David Remer Scott book and just, you know, change it up a little bit and write a blog. It doesn't mean that I know that. You know, I know because I've done the work. Because I've got a portfolio. And so I can show you that I've done not just online marketing, I've done offline marketing. And so that's what, and for me as a hybrid, because I've done all these things. And so when I sit in front of a client, I can tie all the pieces together. Before we started, I think recording, we were talking about sometimes clients, they don't know what they don't know or what they need. And so, you know, if you have when I have an opportunity to sit down with a potential client, I just try to listen. You know, you ask some intelligent questions about their space and what they do, but sometimes they don't know, you know, or they might have an idea, but you have to be able to tie it all together. And I think for marketers or any entrepreneur looking to make a living on their own, it's very hard to do well when you're doing business just as a project. And what I mean by that is that if I build a website for a client, I'm rich while I'm building that website. If I charge $5,000, $6,000, you know, I got six, I'm great. But once that project is over, then I'm off looking for, you know, the next website to develop. I think for marketers in particular, we have to develop products, services, and systems that we own that, you know, we can put clients on retainer for and show value in what we're doing. And that's what I've been able to do. So I've always looked to develop systems. So AdTrack was a system I owned. We built it. And once the technology was built, I could put 100 auto dealers on it every day. You know, it was just a matter of finding those auto dealers, but we had the system, right? And that was actually the first question I would always get whenever I would show it to someone back. So this was back, you know, in like 99, 2000. People were like, you own this? And I didn't understand the why people were so enamored with that. Like, yeah, we build it. I just hired a tech guy. I knew what I wanted to hire him. They're like, wow, you know. So owning a system versus, you know, this project orientation to your business. So whatever you're doing as an entrepreneur, I think you should be looking to develop a system. And today, your system doesn't have, with things like AdWords, with Google and Bing and things like, you don't necessarily have to own that system. You can really develop a system that takes advantage of that, right? So I know an agency, I think they're out of Minneapolis, I believe, that they built a whole service around the Google 360 thing. And they were able to go, and you know, and they only worked with auto dealers, I think. At least they started out that way. And they may have expanded now, but they built a system. They didn't need to own the tech, right? So Google owns the tech, but they built a system around or service around the technology and only service a very specific niche, which at that point was just auto dealers.
So they can build a system that sits on top of someone else's right. platform.
Exactly.
And that's its own kind of hybrid where you now no longer have to build a process from scratch each time you're working with a right. client. You just replicate it and you add the same amount of value, but with far less effort
right.
on each part.
Right. So, you know, and I think also, you know, as you do that and you get good at doing certain things, then sometimes the opportunity to develop your own technology or system will come out of that. You know? But I think the main point today is that, you know, people can make a living, man. You can make a living on your own. You can make a decent living working out of your basement. working out of a small office, working out of a place like this, you can provide for your family. There's nothing wrong with being an employee. I think it's great. You know, it's just hard nowadays. You know, I wanted to be an employee. I kept getting laid off. No fault of my own. It's like, you know, so.
And it's a good opportunity if you're an employee and you have the ability to scout the landscape, you can cherry pick the skills and experiences that you want to develop mm-hmm. while you're with an employer.
Right. And, you know, my wife will get on me if I don't say this. I'm able to do what I'm doing because my wife is an employee. Right. And so I was able to just say, you know what? I can leave this over here because we did have a steady paycheck coming. And so, you know, if you have the benefit of having a partner or being married, if one person is working and has a steady paycheck coming in, then, you know, you have less to worry about, or if they've got an established business and there's money coming in. But I'm able to do what I do because my wife is an employee.
Because you can mitigate some risk and
exactly.
some of the overhead
right.
things
right.
like
so
benefits.
We have benefits.
And,
yeah. Right. Right.
It's such a curious thing talking to American entrepreneurs versus European entrepreneurs, where benefits doesn't even come into
right.
question. They'll just say, you know, there's a guy that sits a few desks away from us at Benjamin's desk here who has come over here from France. And almost every day he's asking, like, why are people so freaked out about healthcare? And that's a thing that for entrepreneurs, that can be a big fear factor.
Well, I provided benefits. So when I ran Stealth Marketing, my wife didn't work. You know, she didn't always have a job. Well, she always had a job, but we homeschooled for a long time. And so if you have money coming in, I was always happy to send that benefit check because it meant that I was earning money. You know, I enjoy paying my taxes, right? Because if I have a tax bill, it shows that I earned money. So you can buy benefits. You know, is it expensive? Yes. Right. But you know, if you've got a business, if you've got a system that's generating revenue for you, you know, you can do these things in America. And I don't think that we should be afraid to do it.
Yeah. So last question, thinking about where you want to go with your business and making that tax return bigger and bigger right. every year. Where do you see things going in 5 to 10 years?
Wow, Joe, I don't know. This project that I'm working on that I can't talk about right now, I think that's probably where I'll be in 5 years. And we'll come back and we'll talk about that, right? So I'm actually hoping that in the next few weeks that it kind of takes off. But that's really where I see me spending most of my time over the next 5 years, because that'll be a national project in scope, because it already is. There are national partners involved in it. So people in general, and where do I see our economy going? I think that, you know, we're no longer, the industrial age lasted 80 years. It's over, right? You know, most people struggle to find jobs. They struggle to keep them, right? And kind of like you said, you know, it's very difficult for someone to work 30 or 40 years someplace anymore, even if you want to. And I have a daughter, Gary, go to college. She's going to the University of Pennsylvania this fall. You know, kids come out of school, hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, and they can't find a job. And so I think that it's going to remain important over the next 5 to 10 years to have an entrepreneurial spirit. You know, even if you come out of school with a law degree, I was on the subway on the way over here, and I was looking because I'm a marketer, right? And I always think about branding. And the guy, and I remember his last name was Saul something, right? And I couldn't, he's an attorney, and it's like, you know, he's an injury attorney, and he's got this thing on the subway. And it doesn't say, you better call Saul, right? And I'm thinking, well, is his head buried in the sand? He's not taking advantage
of the huge missed opportunity.
Right? His actual name is Saul, right? he's not taking advantage of this mass media opportunity. But the point is that, you know, even, and I keep saying this to my daughter, is that many attorneys are entrepreneurs, right? You've got to hone your entrepreneurial skills. Regardless of what you're doing, whether you're in a tech space, and everything is in tech space. If you're an attorney, well, you need a website, right? You know, either you're going to hire somebody to do it. And if you hire someone to do it, you still need to know at least enough to ask the right questions, right? To make sure someone's not leading you astray. So I'd say, you know, develop your entrepreneurial skills, develop your networking skills, you know, learn to like people, you know, because I think that there's with so much emphasis on social media and, you know, building a following, I don't know how many people really get any benefit from it. Yes, I believe some people do. But for the average person, you know, in a market, at least spend some of your time doing some actual networking, getting out, meeting people. What I call in sales, shaking hands and kissing babies. Right? So get out and shake some hands and kiss babies. And that's my favorite thing to do. And I would say that for me, you know, I've had a lot of clientele actually come via the internet, and I have some that come via networking. But the ones I enjoy the most, because I enjoy talking to people, I enjoy going out to networking events, just because I like people, you know, and I like whether any business comes from it or not. So I think that hone your networking skills, hone your entrepreneurial skills, and hone your sales skills, because ultimately we all have to sell, right? You gotta sell something. Regardless of what you're doing in this world, it doesn't happen unless a sale takes place.
Rodney Goldston, RodneyGoldston.com and Jughead Media, thanks for joining us on The Build.
And that's GOLDSTON, period.
Period.
Like San Francisco. Right.
We'll see you again soon.
All right. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Build. We hope you'll share this series with your friends and provide us with feedback on the iTunes Store. You can also subscribe to weekly updates and learn more about upcoming guests by visiting our show page at thebuild.biz. This has been a 2820 radio production.